Hello and welcome to the Permaculture Project this day, April 7th, 2012. Taking care of Earth, taking care of people, and sharing surplus. I'm your host, James Kozlik. This is a call-in show. If you have any questions or want to join the discussion, give us a call. You can try 888-627-6008, or there's several lines. One of them is 503-327-7602, 530-413-4522, and 530-413-5011. And I'll review these lines as we go through the show. Last week, our guest was Charles Stombaugh of the Sergeant Jason James McCluskey Foundation in Libby, Montana. We discussed his foundation, which is dedicated to developing sustainable communities for veterans and returning soldiers. If you'd like to listen in on that show, it was kind of a brainstorming session, and that show is in the archives. And you would just go to BBS Radio, the Permaculture Project, and then you can go into the archives and follow the instructions from there. Today, our show is dedicated to urban gardening with some discussion concerning a more sustainable culture as a permanent culture or social permaculture. Our special guest today is Pokey Peotin from Santa Fe, New Mexico. Pokey is involved with several community garden experiments in the local Santa Fe area. Pokey, how are you doing today?
I'm good, Jim. Happy to be on your show.
Oh, good. Like to go over a little bit of your history, if you don't mind. I'm looking at a bio that I grabbed from the internet, and looks like you have several areas of interest and a lot of background in urban farming and composting and social utilities fostering sustainable culture, which I really want to get into later in the show. A little bit maybe on community land trusts and sustainable construction. You have anything you want to add to that? Without telling us your life, history.
Well, it seems like all these activities have a common thread as I look back into the last, over the last 25 years. And it seems like they have to do with creating environments to foster culture, bring people together, bringing community together, and discovering how we can do community in these times, in the place that we live in. That's kind of the thread, it seems like, that has been through all these endeavors.
Yeah, that's interesting comment, especially doing, all these things in a more sustainable community where we actually live. Mm-hmm. I know sometimes I get the urge to move on in another direction if I don't, because sometimes I feel my local community isn't moving fast enough or taking any action in that direction. Mm-hmm. Have you ever experienced that feeling?
Definitely. And, as I grow a little older, I just turned 54 last month, I'm looking at these areas of, expectations and impatience. And it seems that it's the biggest kind of area of challenges and growth for me as I immerse myself in the creation of these community gardens or these urban farms, to really deal with all the idiosyncrasies of community. And I was speaking with a young woman the other day who was actually very involved in an organization called Earth Care. And they deal with a lot of kids, and they work in school gardens and community gardens. And in the middle of the conversation, she said, community is messy. And it really kind of reassured me in a way that I was actually, not alone in that feeling. And that's kind of where we're at as a culture. We're trying to reinvent ourselves and build community, and we don't really know how to do it because we come from a nuclear kind of family environment. And so the all these aspects of decision-making, communication, conflict resolution, sharing resources, financing project as a collective, they're not easy for any one of us to wrap our minds around. And yet we know we have to do it. We have to kind of evolve into a different culture. And so the places of practice right now are very important. And I think if we all keep in mind that it's not an easy process, that we're going to stumble and fumble and, you know, get mad at each other and get messy, then, you know, it's easier for me to accept that the work is difficult, and we got to figure out a way to do it.
Yeah, and have fun doing it. I know one of our first guests, she had moved from a community that just wasn't, it was a nice community, and she lost interest because nobody wanted to go in any direction. And so she hooked up in a community where she had some common denominators, you know, some like-minded people. And it's worked out pretty good for her, from my understanding. On the other hand, I'm in a community where I see a lot of talent. My community is loaded with talent. And it is a community. I mean, we have great friendships and whatnot that we develop. And sometimes, I don't know, I get the sense of wanting to see more concrete activity. And I think we, in permaculture, we talk a lot about the invisible structure of things, you know, things that we look at that we don't really see but might be actually happening. Well, before I start getting long-winded here, I'd like to go over some of your experiments with community garden. I'd like to start with that San Pancho community garden that were involved with, that used the biodynamic French intensive gardening and the Ralph Steiner method. You want to elaborate a little on that?
Oh, sure. 2 years ago, I was, I was conducting my own little backyard experiment in Santa Fe here, and I was really taken on by composting. So I was starting to gather a lot of food scraps from grocery stores, and very shortly after, and it was actually interesting because I did a prayer at a labyrinth. At a park next to where my little garden was, and just really asking the elements to just bring all the support and all the inspiration that, you know, they could give me. And very shortly after, I was introduced to a gentleman by the name of Joaquin Lawrence Hirschman, who was one of Alan Chadwick's students. And Alan Chadwick is the British gentleman who coined that technique, who merged these two techniques of biodynamic and the French intensive biodynamic coming from Rudolf Steiner. And so I befriended this gentleman, Joaquin, and started working with him at a school here. He was involved in a school garden. And I started building soil because it was in the fall and we were taking more land on the school property. So I learned the French double digging technique, and then he said, "Well, I'm going to Mexico with my partner, and I've worked down there. There's a community center. They'll be very receptive to us doing a community garden. Do you want to come with us?" And I just said yes. I said, this is my chance to go learn with somebody who is, not only very talented but very fascinating character. He's in his 70s. Comes from the hippie era, and has moved his way through all the major, garden projects, Seeds of Change, and so forth. So I just jumped in, and for 4 months, we basically reclaimed a landfill that they call the compost pile, but really, in Mexico, these people just throw everything in the compost pile, including car doors and refrigerators and mattresses. And So we sifted through that pile, which was actually a very fascinating experience because it made me realize how much soil there is in a pile of garbage, you know, when there's been plants. I mean, there were trees in the middle of the compost pile. We had to, after a while, get a backhoe to just, you know, dig the big trees out of it. So we reclaimed about 6,000 square feet of land around this community center, and in the meantime, we were planting in flats, as you know, as you do in that French intensive method. And we planted some 10,000 plants in flats, and then proceeded to, you know, put them in the beds that we had created. So that was my first experience of inviting a community in a small town. This is a little surfing town just north of Puerto Vallarta. Inviting a community, both the locals and the tourists, to participate in an urban garden like this. And so I created a blog, and I just, you know, it's a small town. I would put flyers and talk to everybody about coming to the garden. And we held an open schedule between 11 and 4, I believe, every day, 7 days a week. And so I started to see how, you know, different aspects of a project like that were working or not working. And so from project to project, I've had two other experiences after that doing larger community projects. I started experimenting with different ways to, you know, promote the garden, inviting people to reflect on different ways to organize themselves. And but it's definitely a new experiment for me, and a pretty complex environment, because I never come with, you know, a off the shelf template. Oh, this is how they do it in Chicago, so we're going to do the same thing. Not that I'm opposed to it. It's not my nature to, you know, read a lot or just take things off the shelf. I'm kind of very curious about what emerges from a space that's being created and that people are invited in.
Okay.
And so my, you know, maybe my, the similar, you know, kind of reflection that you gave us at the beginning about frustration, or you wish people were participating more. In Mexico, what I noticed was a lot of people signed up on the blog and, you know, would basically just always, you know, congratulate me when they saw me on the one street, you know, the main street of this little town. Oh, you're doing such a great job, and, you know, it's wonderful what you're doing. But they wouldn't show up in the garden. And I would joke and say, well, you know, I mean, I wouldn't say to them, but in other private conversations, I would say, well, you know, community gardening is not a spectator sport.
Yeah.
Because I love to promote, I love to, you know, put beautiful images and, you know, some writing, whether it's technical or philosophical, on a blog, but it's not to just to be, you know, looked at in front of you at your screen and stay home kind of thing. It's, you know, I intend to have it inspire people to come to the garden.
Oh, and especially when there's double digging involved.
Yeah, that's the part. Well, actually, double digging is...
You know why I had to throw that in? I just couldn't wait any longer to throw that in. I'd like you to describe a little bit about double digging. I just read about it. I've done it in the past, and I get a little confused because there's so many different garden techniques. And
sure.
And just the other day I was doing it in our garden. But could you explain a little bit and what the benefits of that are, or why you do it?
Sure. Well, I'll describe, you know, the method as I understand it and as I've been, you know, shown and I've practiced. The typically, you know, soil, like especially in desert area, is, you know, has a lot of minerals but doesn't have enough organic matter or water or retention of water. So the double digging technique, and it's a little counter, you know, permaculture principles, but, you know, I kind of dance across, you know, all these different message, because sometimes I don't have time to wait for, you know, a field to be covered with mulch and cardboard to create a garden. It would take months, and sometimes I'm kind of on a time crunch in a way to get a season started. So the double digging technique is basically digging these trenches. So if you have a field that's, you know, 20 feet wide by 40 feet long, you would dig your trenches, you know, 20 feet wide, and the trenches are about 18 inches wide and about 10 inches deep. And then, so you start your first trench, you take that soil and bring it to the back of your field, and that pile of soil will fill your last trench. So once you have that first trench open, you clean the bottom of the trench, and then you break the subsoil with a garden fork. So you don't really, you just break the subsoil. Here we call it caliche. It's a very hard clay. And that breaking of the subsoil allows for water to penetrate and roots to go deeper, and it helps loosen up the soil, you know, at a more depth than your trench. Once you've done that digging with a fork, and that's the double digging of that, you know, that name. The first digging is digging your trench, and the double digging is the breaking of the subsoil. Nice. So once you've done that, you fill your trench with organic matter. So that can be straw, hay, alfalfa, and the more, you know, rotten or moldy, the better. And then you put compost or manure, if you don't have compost, over that straw. So you fill your trench, and I say fill it, like your 10 inches or more are filled with this organic matter. And then you start digging your next trench, and the soil from that next trench is thrown over that trench that was filled with organic matter, with straw and compost or manure. So now your soil is rising, and that's where the raised bed name comes from. You know, a lot of people say the raised beds are these planks that they put, and then they put soil in it. But that's kind of like an expedited way to do raised bed. But the real name comes from doing that double digging technique, and because you add all these organic matter in the trench, you soil naturally, you know, you rise up another foot. And it's also very fluffed up because you've been digging that soil and throwing it over that pile of organic matter. So you have a very soft, very porous, aerated soil, and which would be very receptive to moisture or water. And then the blubber that's underneath with all that organic matter becomes like a sponge. So when you water your beds, the bottom of your bed is, you know, basically a water reservoir. And then when you plant your plants, the soil is very soft and aerated, so the roots can actually go really fast and go really deep, and they actually go and reach for that organic matter that's on the bottom of the trench. So that's the double digging technique.
And then you just continue that, so there's no real space between each trench.
No, each trench is, you know, next to each other. So when you finish your field, the last trench that you've dug receives the dirt from the first trench.
Mm-hmm.
And then you have a uniform, you know, double dug garden, and then you create your paths where you want them on that that area. So the paths actually also very permeable, because they have also that organic matter on the bottom. And so that's something that I really observed in these gardens that I did, is the paths are an integral part of your garden. They're not like a road that's, you know, walked on and hard. It's actually also a very soft, porous environment. So when your path gets hard by the walking, you actually get your fork and you break them up. And I do that usually once a week.
Oh, that's a good point. I like that, because I've seen where the path, like you said, gets hard, doesn't get taken care of, then when watering happens, it's like a gutter. And if it's not directed anywhere, it just goes down onto the edges as opposed to absorbing in there.
How
about, let's touch a little bit, you were talking about, you know, when you started doing your, growing your dirt or your compost.
Mm-hmm.
And what, when you put, let's say you're doing double digging, for instance, when you, would you put live compost, you know, something that hasn't necessarily been broken down yet, vegetable scraps, whatever, that just came from the kitchen, and it hasn't broken down in your compost heap, for instance, would you, do you throw that at the bottom of any trenches, or do you ever dig a hole in the middle of, in a garden plot and just let the earth take care of it and worms and whatnot, or do you wait till it's all broken down?
We don't bury compost. You know, we also make piles, and it's definitely inspired by biodynamic techniques and permaculture techniques, where we create a mattress. So we make pretty large compost piles in some of our gardens, but if you're using pallets, for example, which are roughly 4 by 4 by 4, it's a, you know, kind of a 4 cubic or 16 cubic feet, 64. At the bottom of that pile, whatever size you, you make your pile, you actually use branches. And you use a pretty thick amount. Like in the big piles that we're making now, which are about 30 feet long by 10 feet wide, when we put branches down to begin the pile, we actually stack them about 3 feet high. And they can be trunks. I mean, they can be, you know, trunks that are 4 or 5 inches in diameter. And then as you add your matter, and here we're talking about we get about 1,000 pounds of vegetable scraps a week between coffee grounds and vegetables from different restaurants. So the weight actually crushes that mattress to, you know, maybe a foot. And what that does, it creates this air circulation underneath your pile and also a drainage, because you don't want your pile to be too wet. And you also want air to come into the pile to, you know, to feed oxygen to, you know, some of the organisms. So whether you do a large pile, in which case you do a 3-foot mattress, or a smaller pile like in a pallet, then you do maybe a 1-foot mattress with smaller branches. And then you leave that mattress at the bottom of your pile when your pile is matured, and then you dig the soil. And then if you need to add a few more branches to keep that mattress, you know, fairly, you know, substantial, then you can add a few more branches before you start a new pile.
Okay.
But
do you, ever add any dirt along with the vegetables? And?
Oh, sure. Yeah, if you have soil from your garden that's, you know, alive, that's moist and has, you know, bacterial activity in it, yeah, it's great to put it in because you're adding microorganisms. And here we're talking about hot piles, and that's, you know, I'm sure your audience or you do know the difference between, you know, compost you do with your worms and then the hot pile, which, you know, starts with very high temperatures. Once the pile is built to a certain volume, the mass of your compost pile really allows for very high temperatures to take place, and it's mostly due to the bacterial activity. So your piles are at 160 degrees or 140 degrees. So when you throw that dirt, don't throw worms in it, you know, because they won't survive. You know, they don't like temperature above 80. And but to answer your question about putting material in your trench that's not completely composted, say like a, you know, a 3 months old or 2 months old compost that's still smells a little bit, that's not completely turned into soil, all depends when you're going to start planting. Like we just did a field at one of our gardens, and we had 5 compost piles from a pallet size pile. We pulled 3 of them. One was very mature. The other ones were not not finished in their process, but we still put that in the trenches because, you know, the field was going to be staying like this for several months, probably two or three months before it gets planted. That was at the beginning of the winter that we did that in January. So then the incomplete compost in the ground covered with soil continues to, you know, to mature. And now it's, you know, if I were to dig it up, it probably doesn't smell anything. It's turned completely into soil. But I wouldn't put, raw vegetables because they take too long to decompose, and you would not get real food that can be absorbed by plants. It's just too rich, or, it's too much nitrogen.
Okay. How about jumping to this morning when I called you? You were at the Dandelion Ranch.
I'm still at the Dandelion Ranch, actually.
Oh, okay, great. What's going on there? That's an urban farm in Santa Fe, or?
It could be called a farm, but it's more like a homestead. It's actually a half-acre property that has two residents on it. It's a split-level house. And so we're taking the back of the property. So we're taking a quarter of an acre, and the garden is probably an eighth. It's getting a little bigger now. It's probably going to be almost a quarter by the time summer arrives, because we'll keep expanding around the property. And it's the first communal garden in Santa Fe that I did around one family and friends. And we had a pretty late start last year. We started in June, and we double-dug the area that we chose for the garden and started planting, from plants that we got from a friend in Colorado with a greenhouse, with a farmer. And then we started a bunch of flats with the French intensive technique. So within, 7 weeks, we had our own plants. All our lettuce and chard and kale and parsley and all these things were actually grown by us in the flats. So we had a pretty quick garden from starting from a piece of bare ground. Within a month, we had a crop, and our first crop, of course, was weeds, because we used horse manure to create the double digging, and that brought in a lot of purslane and a lot of amaranth. So we let the amaranth actually grow almost, to its full size, 3 feet. And then by the time we were ready to plant, so we harvested the weeds because they're edible. They're actually really great.
Yeah.
And then what we didn't, we had 200 pounds, I think, the first time we did weeding one afternoon. So we put that in the compost, and then people took the rest home. But we made pesto with the purslane, and some other people made some other, sauces, and put recipes with chilies on our blog.
That's great. I'm glad you did that. That's the garden my wife and I are developing. We're trying to phase into a total perennial garden. So when we see purslane growing in there, or amaranth, or anything like that that's identifiable and edible, we just leave it and watch it move from one place to the next, or we move it. So that's, I like that. Now, the Gaia Gardens is kind of new. What's going on there? And by the way, folks, this is all happening in Santa Fe, so if anybody is in the Santa Fe area, you're going to have to check out what Pokey's doing at the end of the show. We'll make sure that there's a connection. All right, so go ahead, Pokey. I didn't mean to interrupt. Oh, I'm sorry. I would like to do one thing here. I'd just like to go over, in case anybody's listening, wants to call in. Line 1 would be 530-327-7602. Line 2 is 530-413-4522. And line 3 is 530-413-5011. And let's get back to Gaia's Garden. In fact, I've got a book named Gaia's Garden.
Mm-hmm.
Is that where you coined it, the phrase from? The name
of
the garden?
No, actually, and it's actually Gaia Gardens. It's
Gaia
Gardens. No S.
Okay.
And,
okay.
No, the name was given by the owner's daughters.
Okay.
The owner has two daughters, 14 and 15, and his older one went to a farm school called Camino de la Paz, it's outside of Santa Fe, and So I just asked them, like, what do you want to call this new place that we're starting? And they just came up with that name, and everybody said yes.
Hmm.
And
sure.
So the way Gaia Gardens started is actually just before I went to Mexico 2 years ago, I was exploring and putting the call out that I was looking for land in town to create a prototype of urban farming. And I got offered a fair amount of land, and I went to look at every one of them. And that place stood out for a variety of reasons. It's really in the heart of town. It's right off a bicycle trail. It's next to two big high schools. It has two wells. One is not active. We're going to reactivate it. And the land was, you know, just like every piece of land in New Mexico or, you know, in high desert places, very dry, very rocky. And, you know, to most people, not appealing to do gardening. That's why a lot of people don't in these climates. And so it kind of fit a profile that, you know, we wanted versus, you know, going for a piece of land that's been cultivated for a long time, that has a lot of soil, or a piece of land next to a creek or an arroyo. And so we, I waited a year before, you know, I was able to go back to the owner and say, okay, we're ready. So we broke ground February 15th this year, and I've been proceeding, you know, creating soil, basically. You know, we were fortunately offered some machinery to help remove all the rocks and open the land. And again, you know, a little bit of a quandary or, you know, kind of clash with permaculture principles of not disturbing the soil. But the soil was almost like a parking lot. You know, it was just more rocks than soil. So we had to, you know, remove the larger rocks. And we did a lot of it with machinery, but we also did a lot of it by hand. And now we're just starting to create the beds. And on that note, something very funny happened a couple of days ago, because I created the first bed, and this is 150 by 50 field. And I was just wondering what kind of patterns of beds I was going to create, because just very long beds are very conducive to, you know, some types of irrigation like T-tape, which doesn't bend very well at all. So you need to have straight lines. This is for kind of farm applications. And it's also affordable for people like us who are on very tight budgets. But I wanted to break the field to not have just these rows of, you know, of vegetables. So I started with a very large circle in the middle of the field, and I created two beds, one inside of another, and the outer bed being probably 42 feet or something like that. And then I took a picture after I was done, and of course it looks like a crop circle, so I posted it on Facebook. Amazing. Mm. Crop circles in Santa Fe. And the next day I get a call from a crop circle researcher in Ohio who, doing her, you know, morning research, somehow found us on Google and didn't realize that it was a joke. So now I'm inspired to do other jokes like that, like Sasquatch spotted at Gaia Gardens. You know, whatever we get, we can do to draw some attention.
Yeah, that's funny. Especially in this on BBS radio, there's a lot of shows that talk about crop circles and UFOs, etc. So that's great. Hey, I want to skip a little bit and get away from some of the gardening techniques and what's going on there. And you had some experience with community land trusts.
Mm-hmm.
And I want to tell you why I'd like to touch on that subject. Some of my background is real estate, and I sell raw land, and I see these large tracts that we have, and I've been advertising people to see if there be a group purchase. And I was doing some research on community land trusts so that you can get around, you know, not necessarily get around or bypass the subdivision laws in different regions, but, you know, something that where people have an opportunity, and that land always has to be used for a specific reason. And that might be like an agricultural community land trust. Where what I'd like you to just kind of go over a little bit what your involvement was with community land trusts in the past, if you can have any recall.
Yeah, absolutely. Actually, I didn't know anything about land trust. I mean, I had heard the term, but at the time I thought land trusts were just big parcels of land that were purchased by foundations like, you know, Sierra Club or
right,
and to preserve them from development.
Right, and that's usually what you see. We get a lot of that here in Montana.
Mm-hmm. Development or clear cutting and so forth.
Mm-hmm.
But I discovered that there's a lot of other forms of land trust that in their mandate or their, you know, mission have definitely the preservation of land and keeping it away from speculation. But they also have this mandate of education, agriculture, and community. So I, at the time, I lived in Seattle, and came across this pretty large land trust called the Evergreen Land Trust, which has been in existence for, you know, since the 70s, and had several properties, had three farm properties and two houses in the city that, of course, were not, you know, centered around agriculture, but they were centered around communal living. And so I actually was accepted as a member on one of the farms, which was an hour and 15 minutes from Santa Fe. The farm was called Pragtree. And then I was there for 3.5 years and immersed myself in the land trust, you know, kind of philosophy, which is really about sharing land, making decision in consensus, which is a very hard topic or hard practice, and sharing your environment with the broader community for education. And since we were a farm and had previous tenants, we were into permaculture. We had some element of permaculture. We had a big orchard. We had a lot of composting toilets because we received groups of up to 50 people or more. And so I was very actually taken by the concept of land trust, because in that particular one, and each one has a different kind of, you know, set of bylaws, but in the particular one that I was in, you had a process to be accepted as a full-time member. So there was a year probation or process during which you're, you know, evaluated by the existing community, and then you're voted in or you're accepted as a full-time member. Once you're a full-time member, unless you get you know, booted out also by a consensus, you know, decision, you have a right to be on that land up to 99 years. And that's that you can actually pass that on to your children in that particular land trust. And you can also build a structure if there are, or move in a structure if there's a group house, for example, or purchase a structure if there's some members leaving the property. But the way the bylaws are created, the properties cannot be speculated on. So if you build a property for, you know, say $50,000, you can only sell it with, you know, the cost of living increase over the few years that you had the property. It's not like you can put it on the market, for example. It has to be sold to a member that's accepted by the community. So there's a protection, you know, when there's vacancies to the community, that the people coming in are not just strangers. They're just, you know, they are communal minded. They know what they're getting into. They have to abide by all the, you know, the agreements that the community lives with. And but the land itself is not in the hands of any particular individual. It's, you know, it's held in trust by a nonprofit, which is what a land trust is. It's a nonprofit. So the land is basically managed by the board of directors. And the bylaws said that the land cannot be sold for speculation. So if the board stays, you know, in integrity, the land cannot be sold. So it stays as a land trust from generation to generation. And there's like states like Vermont or cities like, you know, Burlington, Vermont, they realized that they would have, you know, they would buy land and then they would develop housing for low-income people. But then the neighborhood would gentrify, and then the low-income houses would be sold, you know, to the highest bidder. And the whole concept of low-income housing would disappear. So they started putting their properties in trust with the same kind of bylaws that would guarantee that the properties cannot be, you know, falling into speculation and keeping these neighborhoods for low income.
That makes a lot of sense. Mm-hmm. You know, when I first opened up the show there, I saw in your history there that you had an interest in social utilities fostering sustainable culture. And as I went through your bio on your blog, the Nautilus, is that did I say that right? Project.
Mm-hmm.
I'd like to. I have a very fond interest of what that is all about. What you're doing there. I know you mentioned earlier or yesterday when we talked that's kind of on hold right now. But. What's your vision there? What's going on with the Nautilus Project?
Mm-hmm. Well, to just backtrack a little bit, I in the 90s, I started a company that was representing building contractors, and I was also involved in an eco-building guild. And I for 7 years, I managed and grew this company and sold it to an internet company. So through these years, I was, and then I went to work for that internet company. Through all these years, I had to dabble with software, which had to do with matchmaking. You know, matchmaking homeowners with contractors along very specific lines of budget and quality and, you know, personalities and so forth. And I was a hands-on designer of software for my own company. I ended up selling the software to several companies like this around the country. So I always have had this kind of training in matchmaking in a way through a digital environment. And so at the later on, like I think it was around 2004, I was involved in another project of, you know, one of my many projects of actually offering sacred dance rituals, and I was traveling around the country. And I was involved in one liberal college called the Evergreen State College in Olympia, in Washington. I was involved with a lot of young people who were all into permaculture. And I was reflecting on how beautiful it would be to match these young kids who were very creative, very resourceful, hard worker, but landless. Match them with people who have land, like retiring farmers or, you know, farmers in very depressed areas, and bring this workforce onto their land. But again, there's a lot of matchmaking that needs to happen, because you can't parachute, you know, some 20-year-old onto the middle of the, you know, the country in the Midwest and expect the combination to work. So I was reflecting on a digital environment that would be able to bring these different groups together, these different resources together, from people who can finance, people who can design, people who can facilitate, people who can build, and emerge or facilitate the creation of new farms. with new principles, in particular permaculture principles. And so I talked to a friend of mine who is a philanthropist and has funded some of my projects before, and she said, I want to do this. And so I waited another year or two because I was, again, involved in that dance project, sacred dance project. And then I was ready after that to just look at how I could design this digital environment, this social network, as social utility. And so I spent about 2 years with different, you know, groups, organizations, and programmers to see how we could come up with something very unique and also very efficient, because, you know, everybody's familiar with Facebook or everybody's familiar with Craigslist, but, you know, they're kind of either very time-consuming or they don't really speak to you in response to your needs, or they're very distracting, or, you know, there was something missing for me in terms of using the internet intelligently that I was looking at finding to really facilitate the emergence of new culture, like really matching resources for projects to happen, whether you want to do a daycare, a new neighborhood, or organic grocery stores, or an urban farm. You would be able to have this digital environment really bring all these things to your screen, in a way, to your desktop, without having to look for them. They would actually come to you. But what happened is, in the course of, you know, kind of trying to create this tool, it got bigger and bigger, because I realized that, you know, if we didn't address digital currency and elder care and education and transportation and habitat, you know, we were too ingrained into the matrix to really extract ourselves and create a new culture. So I had to deal with all these topics and try to weave them together to really allow people to just kind of leave the matrix and really find the support system to really create a new livelihood, new form of, you know, raising their children, growing food, dealing with, you know, barter or different, you know, kind of currency system. So it got so big that actually it was very difficult to code, in a way, or attract programmers to really start somewhere that would quickly gain momentum. So I had to put it on ice, and I think for good reasons, because I got drawn to doing kind of groundwork with gardening. And this is teaching me a lot, actually. It's a good start for maybe the future of Nautilus, is just starting with the soil. So that's, yeah, that's where I'm at right now.
Well, you know, there is a website, a virtual reality website called Second Life.
Mm-hmm.
It's funny that now that you explained what this your project was, I actually went on there. I just didn't have enough time to sit in front of the computer, but you can create your community, your business on this Second Life. I urge you to check it out. It's pretty fascinating. You create your characters, and then people start joining other members in Second Life once they get to know what you're doing and what you're about. There's people that have actually created real-life businesses off of the virtual community, you know, nightclubs and whatever. And but this is fascinating. I'd love to see your project actually work in real life without having to go just through the software matching people. You know, do you have any interest in continuing that or looking at it in another form? And just, to me, it's creating community. And what I gather just from reading and talking to younger people, and I'm talking in their 20s to mid, you know, to 30s, people are seeing that the life that our generation lived, or the generation before us, just doesn't fit their matrix anymore. Mm-hmm. You know, they're looking at other alternatives. I read a lot of stories about younger people just deciding, forget it, we're going to go farm somewhere or right, do something different. And I really see a sense of not only younger people, but even older people baby boomers looking at shared housing projects and whatnot, you know, that where this matchmaking or sounds like a very worthwhile pursuit.
Yes, and, you know, maybe I was a little, you know, kind of ahead of my time in a way or too ambitious. But in the course of all the work I did and research I did, I came across a lot of groups who were working on the same thing.
Mm-hmm.
And the trick is that the digital world sometimes fascinates programmers. They want to do very abstract things, or they want to design apps that are very glittery and so forth. You know, there's a danger sometimes in that world that the digital kind of framework is kind of hypnotizing people and kids in particular, and pulling them away from a reality we need to really address. Like, you know, where are the kids going to live or work? Not just the kids, when, you know, the real estate market is inaccessible, or jobs are really difficult to get. And what's the alternative world we create, and that we can still make very comfortable, but we have to kind of reshuffle the cards and, you know, let go of certain things in order to get other things. Like, I've let go of the car 6 years ago, and I bike everywhere. I've got trailers, different trailers for different applications. and I choose to live, you know, in the heart of town, in towns that are, you know, kind of suitable for bicycling. And Santa Fe, a lot of people say, well, it's not the best bicycle town. I find it great. There's beautiful bicycle trails. You just have to, you know, kind of figure out how to stay away from the dangerous, you know, thoroughfares.
Right.
And so, you know, I know we only have a few minutes left, but the dance between, you know, really using the digital media and the internet to really serve the creation of a culture is a fine, you know, kind of, it's a really beautiful thing we've created. But just like the car is a beautiful thing we created, just like, you know, heat or electricity, but we can also get really enamored by it or hypnotized by it, enslaved by it. And so for me, like, I've kind of moved away from the screen, even though I'm a heavy user, but I do a lot of kind of networking. I just don't receive, I don't get distracted by YouTubes or Facebooks, because I only have so many hours during the day and there's so much to do. So we have to be very disciplined, and I think it's kind of something I'm, you know, sometimes having heartaches around, is how the kids just get sucked in that media, which is endlessly distracting and entertaining. And when they could actually be in the field or in the shop or, you know, with mentors and actually really learning tools that will serve them well, instead of, you know, having to be dependent on the corporate system that's going to be, you know, face it, you know, or accept it or not, enslave you to a 9-to-5 kind of routine. And not a very creative one for most people. And so, you know, both for ourselves as, you know, responsible individuals and the kids that are around us, we have to really look at this tool, the internet, as something to use wisely. You know, get what you need and go outside the house, go into the world, meet people, and co-create with them. You know, really find a way to join force with other ideas and other, you know, projects, and really put your life force to work, because we really need it. You know, we can't just let Monsanto or, you know, or Microsoft dictate our existence.
Amen. Amen to that, brother. Boy. Now, Polky, some of these the gardens that you're working with, Dandelion Ranch, Gaia Gardens, do you actually advertise yourself that way to create these gardens, or if somebody wanted to get a hold of you to do a community garden for their family or a neighborhood in your local area, how can they get a hold of you?
Well, both
or
your
are
projects...
you willing to do that? I mean, is that...
Oh,
are
sure.
You... Yeah, okay.
I mean, our blogs are very public. I mean, these are not private conversations
right.
or private. And really, and the when we call them community gardens, they're different than like the pea patch that people are familiar with.
Mm-hmm.
These are, it's like one garden that everybody that comes in participates in. Whatever the activities of the day are, whether it's like today, like if you we had a camera in the back, there's people moving rocks into the arroyo to strengthen the shores. There's people planting lettuce, harvesting. There's another person building a kitchen outside, an outdoor kitchen. So when you come in, there's always activities to participate in. And if you need food, when there's food, you just grab a bag or you go harvest. And there's a flow there that happens where you come in to learn, teach, give, receive, share, bring you skills. There's a multitude of things that happen that are all peripheral to, you know, whether it's a garden or a farm, it's the same thing. You have to build fences, you have to have irrigation, you have to fix tools, you have to sharpen your tools, you have to plant seeds, you have to save seeds. And so we offer this, we call it a sharing garden or
about
a communal 30 garden
seconds,
where
30 seconds.
We're learning how to, you know, create this together. We're trying to figure it out, you know, as I mentioned at the beginning, making decisions and financing and sharing and bringing new people in and so forth.
Okay. Terrific. Well, it's time to wrap up the show. I've really enjoyed our conversation, Pokey. It's boy, there's a connection there that I feel with you. Love to have you on maybe in the future if that ever aspires. If anybody wants to go to your blog, I've got pokeybio.blogspot.com.
Yeah, so they can Google, you know, Dandelion Ranch Santa Fe or Gaia Garden Santa Fe or go to Homegrown New Mexico, and we're listed there. We're easy to find.
Okay, great. In fact, speaking of Homegrown New Mexico, I talked with Amy and hope to have her on a future show, and we'll talk a little bit about that. All right, Pokey, I thank you very much for this interview today.
Well, it's been a pleasure, Jim. Thanks for having me on your show, and I look forward to listening to Amy whenever you have her. She does wonderful work in our area here with Homegrown New Mexico.
Great. Well, that's it, folks, for this week. Join us in 2 weeks when the show will focus on more permaculture garden techniques. We're going to continue to focus on all aspects of social permaculture, so future shows will be about communication and personal relationships in communities, local sustainable businesses, co-housing. In fact, I hope to have somebody local here, Ruth Marion, who owns or runs a massage school in Bozeman, Montana, as an upcoming guest to discuss the inception of a shared housing community in Bozeman area. I'm also seeking guests for discussions on conscious currency. And in June, I'm looking forward to having John Jevons on the show to discuss methods of biodynamic gardening and especially creating soil from your garden. Next Saturday is going to be the Urban Farmer. That's a weekly show that covers all aspects of our conscious awareness to care for people, care for earth, and share surplus. Go to www.bbsradio.com/permaculture project/for weekly updates, topics, and guest lists. Adios.